Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, May 22nd, 2021. Now we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to another edition of our program. A little bit later on, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the aftermath of a ceasefire between the Palestinian resistance forces and the State of Israel. There's been more video footage involving the death of Ronald Green in Louisiana that has been released to the general public. Africa is far behind in regard to access to COVID-19 vaccines in comparison to other geopolitical regions. We'll have details on that as well. And the leader of the Polisario Front from the Western Sahara has generated a diplomatic row between Spain and Morocco related to the flow of migrants into Southern Europe. In the second hour, we listened to a press conference held by the World Health Organization, which was attended by the coordinator of the Africa region for the WHO, Dr. Masadiso Mwetsi, discussing the lack of COVID-19 vaccines across the continent. Finally, we review a number of current issues impacting Africa and other areas, geopolitical areas around the globe. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. So stay tuned. We're going to take a musical interlude, and we'll be back with more of our program for this week.
Oh, لست أنساك طائر الشوق حقي وغني ألمي لك إبقاء مجل المنعم وسجن للقادر المحتكم وحنيني لك يكوي الضياء وحنيني لك يكوي الضياء وحنيني لك يكوي الضياء والتوالي واثق ظالم الحزن وفراش مجلس أنت به فتنة تامة سلام وقلب هائم وفراش حائر من كذا ومن الشوق رسول بيننا ونديم قد لما كسانا ومن الشوق رسول بيننا ونديم قد لما من الشوق رسول بيننا ونديم قد سمى الكاس لنا هل Thank you. I don't know. أحلام القرى يقظة صاحت بأحلام القرى وتولى
Thank you.
اللقاء فإذا أنكر كل خلاه وتلاقينا لقاء الغرباء ومضى كل إلى غايته لا تقل شئنا فإن الحظ شاء
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. Today is Saturday, May 22nd, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. That was the voice of Mkaltoum from Egypt. That was a live concert from February 15th, 1968 in Cairo, Egypt. Umm Kulthum, the legendary vocalist in Egypt for many, many years. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. And our lead story deals with the current situation in Palestine in the aftermath of a ceasefire between the resistance forces, the Palestinian people, and the Israeli regime. And in regard to the solidarity shown to Palestine, this has been an international phenomenon over the last week and a half, where millions have gone into the streets and demonstrated in solidarity with the Palestinian people in their struggle for justice, national liberation, and unity. In Iran, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps chief, the Major General Hossein Salami, left the stage after delivering a speech during a rally. He condemned Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. This event took place in the capital of Tehran. Chief Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, did reaffirm Iran's support for the Palestinian nation after resistance movements in Gaza emerged victorious in the face of Israeli military aggression. Salami made the remarks on this evening in separate telephone conversations with Ismail Haniyeh and Ziad el-Nahakla, leaders of Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements. Speaking to Haniyeh, Salami praised the latest achievement made by the Palestinian resistance group, saying, quote, Iran is already to provide all kinds of assistance to the Palestinian nation and resistance forces in all areas, and it will spare no effort in this regard, unquote. Haniyeh, for his part, deeply appreciated Iran's firm stance on the Palestinians' rights in various political and field areas, as well as his standing alongside the Palestinians and resistance groups. Quote, the Palestinian resistance created a heroic epic and defeated the Zionist bullying, he said. The balance of power has changed on the battlefield, and the Palestinian nation across the country and even abroad have rejected the occupation as well as its policies and actions. During the call with the Hakla, Salami stressed that the IRGC will never leave the Palestinian nation alone. The Islamic Jihad leader, for his part, thanked General Qasem Soleimani, the former commander of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Force, for his efforts to achieve and consolidate the resistance victory. General Soleimani, Iran's legendary anti-terror commander, was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad International Airport last year. You were with us in all fields. You are our partner in the realization of victory. And in the future, you will be with us for the liberation of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, Nahla said. He also noted that the latest conflict with the Zionist enemy led to, quote, an unprecedented alliance, unquote, among Palestinian groups. This battle took place within the framework of a cohesive and coordinated front that believes in the liberation of Al-Quds and tries to defend it. Israel launched a bloody bombing campaign on Gaza on May 10 after harassment of Palestinians in Jerusalem Al-Quds and attempts to steal their lands in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem. The occupying regime announced a unilateral ceasefire on Friday, which was accepted by the Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza with Egyptian mediation. Now, the Palestinians celebrated their victory against the Israeli regime as a ceasefire unilaterally declared by Tel Aviv and accepted by resistance groups in Gaza goes into effect. According to Gaza's health ministry, 248 Palestinians were killed in the Israeli offensive, including 66 children and 39 women, and at least 1,910 were injured. During the fighting, Gaza-based resistance factions fired rockets into the occupied territories in response to the Israeli bloodshed. Early today, Ali Akbar Vilayati, a senior advisor to the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, congratulated the Palestinians on their victory against Israel. He said, quote, I congratulate all the honorable people of Palestine, fighters, the resistance front, and especially the families of the martyrs on this great success and historic victory that proved the false aura of the usurping and occupying Zionist regime. Undoubtedly, the continuation of resistance and struggle against the Zionist enemy and the growing trends of victories from the beginning of the third millennium will herald the final victories of the Muslim Ummah over the fake, empty, and usurping Zionist regime, he said. He went on to say, and we quote, "The Islamic Republic of Iran declared its resolve to fully support the oppressed people of Palestine, the Intifada, and all the brave fighters on the front line, commanders and leaders in the phone calls with the leaders of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and during this cruel war. It should be emphasized once again that the decisive policy of the Islamic Republic regarding the most important issue of the Muslim world, namely Palestine, is a fixed and unchangeable policy, with a final victory ending the aggression and occupation of the Islamic Holy Land," unquote. He added, quote, "Muslims and freedom seekers are witnessing once again that the Intifada, which began with stones at the beginning of the 21st century, shifted the balance of power in favor of the oppressed people of Palestine with its growing missile power," unquote. The arm of peace regime surrendered to the will and resistance of the brave Palestinian nation, who selflessly stood up to uphold their inalienable rights, unquote. In other news, here in the United States, more footage of a deadly 2019 encounter of the United States police troopers in Louisiana of kicking and dragging a handcuffed black man has been released by authorities. The authorities released the body cam footage on Friday night that shows a high-speed pursuit and Louisiana state troopers punching motorist Ronald Green while he was already in handcuffs. The 49-year-old African-American was also dragged across the ground by shackled feet and stunned with tasers as he cried, "I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm sorry. I'm scared." The authorities said two state troopers were notified that they will be suspended. Police said Green led police officers on a high-speed chase on May 10, 2019, and crashed his car before being taken into custody. Green was dragged on his stomach by the leg shackles following his violent arrest, according to reports. The internal state police records obtained recently by the Associated Press marked the first public acknowledgement by state police that Green was mistreated. The records confirmed details provided last year by an attorney for Green's family who viewed a graphic body video of the 2019 arrest. And you can read this article in detail by merely logging on to the Pan-African News Wire. And you're listening to the Pan-African News Wire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. The United Nations Security Council has called for accelerated availability of coronavirus vaccines for Africa. This took place earlier this week on Wednesday. They expressed concern that the continent has received only about 2% of all the doses administered around the world. The call came in a presidential statement approved by all 15 members of the council meeting on promoting post-pandemic recovery in Africa and addressing the root causes of conflict on the continent. It reiterated the need for, quote, equitable access to quality, safe, efficacious and affordable COVID-19 diagnosis, diagnostics, therapeutics, medicines, and vaccinations to all, unquote. The statement urged, quote, increased and accelerated donation of safe and effective vaccine doses from developed economies, unquote. And others with supplies to African countries in need, especially through the World Health Organization, the ACT Accelerator Program, which includes COVAX, the facility to buy and deliver vaccines for the world's most underdeveloped countries. The council also acknowledged that discussions are underway on waiving intellectual property protections for coronavirus vaccines aimed at providing vaccinations to Africans and all others in need. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the council meeting organized by China that the limited supply and access to vaccines is hampering and delaying Africa's recovery from the pandemic. And finally, in regard to our relations between the North African state of Morocco and the nation of Spain in Southern Europe, leader Brahim Ghali of the Polisario Front has been treated in Spain for complications related to COVID-19. This has been uncovered by the international press, And as a result, it appears as if Morocco is allowing more migrants to attempt to cross over into Spain. Rabat, which regards Ghali as a terrorist, although he's a leader of a legitimately recognized liberation struggle, protested Spain's decision to grant compassionate assistance to what Morocco considers to be their main enemy. Morocco threatened Spain there would be, quote, consequences, unquote. They finally came to fruition this week when Morocco let down its guard on the border with Ceuta, which is considered a Spanish city in the Mediterranean, but of course it is quite close to the African continent. The move allowed thousands of migrants to enter Ceuta, many of them children who swam or jumped over fences. The humanitarian crisis has become a flashpoint between the two neighbors. Morocco recalled its ambassador in Madrid. Spain is under fire from human rights groups for pushing back most of the trespassers in bulk, which is illegal under international law. And in what resembled an assertion of its sovereignty of Ceuta, which many Moroccan nationalists deem a colony of Madrid, along with the nearby Spanish city of Medina, Spain deployed soldiers to the border. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez also made a quick trip to the overwhelmed city. The Western Sahara region stretches along Africa's Atlantic coast and is home to roughly 600,000 people. Since Morocco annexed the territory in 1975, filling a void left by Spanish imperialism, Spain withdrew as a colonial power in 1975. The international community, particularly the United States, has sabotaged the efforts by the Sahrawi people to establish the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, which they have a provisional government, is even recognized by the United Nations as well as the African Union. Now, an announcement by the United States late last year supporting Rabat's claim, this was under the Trump administration, in exchange for Morocco normalizing ties with the State of Israel, undermined efforts to bring about any type of settlement. This rallied other countries behind Morocco's proposal to give the territory greater autonomy. Now, pushing instead for a referendum on self-determination has been the main focus of the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic of the Polisario Front, based in the Western Sahara. Ghali was elected president of the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic in 2016. He previously served as its defense minister and as a Polisario diplomat in Spain between 1999 and 2008. He was also stationed in Algeria between 2008 and 2015. And, of course, Ghali, wearing combat fatigues while speaking in February at a military parade marking the 45th anniversary of the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, called a new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden to find a solution that would allow the Sahrawi to, quote, enjoy their inalienable right of freedom and independence, unquote. At the San Pedro Hospital in Logrono, there's a little sign on the presence There's little sign of the presence of the Polisario's top man. People familiar with his condition say he recently came out 3 weeks in critical care. A security guard performs identity checks on medical personnel and visitors entering the COVID-19 ward. Inside, Ghali receives a daily visit from his personal physician, who is an Algerian doctor, according to a police report seen by the Associated Press. And you can read this article in its entirety and detail by merely logging on to the Pan-African Newswire. And that's going to conclude our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. We want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. This press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers and magazines and journals and research reports and on various blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And you can log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. Just go to our website at Pan-African News. www.pan-african-news.blogspot.com. That's pan-african-news.blogspot.com. And if you want to, of course, as well, listen to the Pan-African News, Pan-African Newswire, you can read, and also you can listen to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast. All you need to do to listen to the program is to go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. You can listen to this program again. You can share with other potential listeners through social media, through blogs and websites, through emails. And you can also listen to over 1,000 other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of this program for this week.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree. Joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And then you're bound to see my other side. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. I get more than my share, but that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you. Oh, 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 baby, I'm just human. Don't you know I have faults like anyone? Sometimes I find myself alone regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing that I've done. 'Cause I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast. That was the voice of Nina Simone. And the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast, is here every week, and we're broadcasting today, Saturday, May 22nd, 2021, from our studios in downtown Detroit. And, of course, as we mentioned before, if you want to have access to this program as well as other programs, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And, of course, we have been covering the developments surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic from its inception, providing briefings from the World Health Organization. And we have one that was done earlier discussing the whole question of the availability of vaccines. And of course, this is a major, major problem internationally. Africa, as reported in the Pan-African Newswire segment, has access to 2% of all of the vaccines that are available internationally. The People's Republic of China has stepped up and pledged to provide vaccinations to 40 different countries, and we'll have reports on that as things develop. And, of course, we are very much concerned about the potential for further spread of the COVID-19 pandemic on the African continent. There was a World Health Organization briefing before the World Economic Forum yesterday, and it was addressed by the African Region Coordinator for the World Health Organization. And let's listen in to this briefing.
From the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, my name is Adrian Monk. This is the WHO media briefing for Africa. And I'm delighted to say that we are joined from Brazzaville by Dr. Matshidiso Moeti, who is the regional director of the WHO. Also joined here by Dina Ringold from the World Bank. She's regional director of human development for Western and Central Africa. And from Standard Chartered, we have Razia Khan, who's head of research and chief economist for Africa and the Middle East. Standing by as well to take questions, we have Dr. Richard Mahigo, who's WHO Regional Office for Africa Coordinator on Immunization and Vaccine Development. We want your questions. We have taken questions already from folks across Africa's media. Thank you so much for joining us. But first, turning to Dr. Moeti, really on an idea of the very grave situation that the continent is facing in respect of the pandemic. Dr. Moeti.
Thank you very much, Adrian. I'd like to join you in warmly welcoming Ms. Dina Ringold and Ms. Razia Khan to this press conference. And I very much look forward to hearing their perspectives on the economic costs of the COVID-19 pandemic and on financing the vaccine rollout. Dina, thank you so much for joining us so early in the morning where you are. And Razia, it's wonderful to meet you, my compatriot, in this press conference. There have now been 4.7 million COVID-19 cases and 127,000 lives sadly lost on the African continent. So far, 24 million Africans have received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine and 5.5 million have received two doses. So when we look at access to the vaccines, we see great inequalities across countries. Seychelles is one of the most vaccinated countries in the world, with 67% of the population having received at least one dose. In Morocco, they've reached 29%, and in Mauritius, 17%. Whereas in 14 African countries, less than 1% of the population has received a single dose, and in four countries, vaccination hasn't started at all. COVID-19 vaccine shipments to African countries have slowed down to a trickle this month because of the reliance on India as one of the key manufacturers globally and the devastating surge of cases that that country is dealing with. The continent was expecting 66 million doses through COVAX from February to May, but instead has so far received only 18.2 million. While in Africa, on average, fewer than 2 in 100, that's 2%, people have received a dose of COVID-19 vaccine. In some high-income countries, more than 8 out of 10 people, that's 80%, have been reached. Such a huge difference. This means that as people living in richer countries can hit the reset button this summer and their lives will return to a semblance of normal, in Africa, our lives will continue to be on hold. We can still catch up and make up for the lost ground, but time is running out. While African countries await shipments of COVID-19 vaccines, many are struggling to roll out even their limited doses and second doses to complete the course of vaccination are at risk. Funding for operational costs is also a critical barrier. it's estimated that 60% of every dollar spent on delivering vaccines is needed for logistics and operations. Urgent action, therefore, is needed to finance Africa's COVID-19 vaccine rollout. The World Bank estimates, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from Dina, that in addition to the $9.5 billion needed to buy enough vaccines to ensure adequate protection from the virus, another $3 billion is required to fund vaccinators, cold room storage, logistics, equipment, and transport to deliver them. COVAX, the World Bank, and other partners are supporting co-financing of these additional costs, but countries need to develop robust financial plans and cost estimates to access these funds. As WHO, we're working with governments to improve planning and costing for the operational and delivery processes to support COVID-19 vaccine rollout and providing support to access funding opportunities. We are also collaborating closely with the African Union, the Africa CDC, on their efforts with the Afrexim Bank. International solidarity is crucial in supporting the vaccine rollout. Excuse me. We welcome the pledge by the United States this week to share 80 million doses with other countries, with a substantial proportion expected to go through the COVAX, in addition to recent shipments of vaccines from France to Mauritania and pledges by several other high-income countries. There is great interest and push for manufacturing on the African continent, and this is a promising medium to long-term solution. To save lives and prevent severe illness now and speed up the recovery from the pandemic, it's in the interest of all countries to rapidly increase coverage of the vaccines globally. African countries also need to see what domestic resources are available to support the social and economic priority. So it's critical to use this time while there are only limited resources to cost and plan for a more effective rollout and ensure that all doses are used as effectively as possible. So I look forward to a very good discussion of these matters with you. And again, welcome and thank you for having joined us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Murthy. Can I turn to Dina Ringold in Washington, D.C. at the World Bank? Dina, can you tell us what the World Bank is doing to help finance the vaccines that Africa needs and how that money gets into the pockets of those who need it to make things happen?
Sure. Thank you, Adrian. Good morning, good day to everyone. And really thank you to Dr. Moiti and WHO colleagues for the invitation to be here. And nice to meet you today, Razia. So I'm pleased to join you to talk about the World Bank's response to the COVID-19 pandemic in sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly the role that we're playing currently in the vaccine rollout. We know that this COVID-19 pandemic continues to exert pressure on African economies and exacerbate poverty, and tens of millions of people are falling into poverty. In addition to the loss of lives and human capital, we estimate that every month of delay in the provision of COVID-19 vaccines has the potential to cost the African continent close to $14 billion in lost GDP. So this is an economic and a social crisis. Overall, our response to the pandemic has been the largest and fastest response that we've mounted to a crisis in the history of the institution. If I roll back to March of last year, our initial global package for health response involved preparing 100 projects in 100 days to help countries fight the pandemic through building capacity for testing, surveillance, and treatment. And in Africa, this involved about $1 billion US dollars for 39 countries in the continent. And this was alongside our broader effort that was focused on saving lives, but also saving livelihoods through social protection, ensuring sustainable business growth, and working to build a more resilient recovery. And we've been also doing this in partnership with regional institutions such as WHO and the Africa CDC, which have been playing a critical role during the pandemic. Moving to vaccines, last fall, our board of directors approved a $12 billion US dollar package to help countries purchase and deploy COVID-19 vaccines. At the same time, we worked closely with our partners, WHO, UNICEF, and Gavi, to support countries in preparing vaccine readiness assessments and national vaccine plans to guide deployment. As of today, we have received requests from 36 countries in Africa for vaccine financing amounting to close to $2 billion. And this includes seven projects for seven countries that have already been approved by our board and an additional 29 that are at varying stages of preparation. We are working to help countries acquire vaccines through COVAX and also directly with manufacturers. And as Dr. Moeti said, the challenge goes beyond purchasing vaccines. We're working with countries to support deployment. The readiness assessment identified and underscored key gaps, including in cold chain equipment, energy infrastructure, logistics, transport, community engagement, and in many cases, most critically, the human resources needed to deploy the vaccine. I want to underscore that our work during the pandemic builds on the longstanding engagement that the World Bank has in the health sector in Africa. And we've seen that the COVID-19 crisis has strained already weak health systems and reinforced the urgency of ongoing efforts to strengthen health systems, move towards universal health coverage and service delivery. So in conclusion, I want to emphasize that fair, broad, and fast access to safe and effective COVID-19 vaccines, alongside ongoing work on testing, treatment, and building strong health systems, are the critical ingredients for protecting lives and stimulating economic recovery on the continent. Only once the pandemic is contained in all countries will each country be safe from a resurgence. So the World Bank is committed to working with countries and our partners to increase the supply of vaccines to Africa. Thank you.
Dina, thank you for that. You touched there upon the economic impacts the crisis is having across Africa. Perhaps we can explore that in a little bit more depth with Razia Khan from Standard Chartered. Razia, can you give us more insight into how hard the pandemic is hitting African economies?
Thank you, Adrian. We know that unlike last year when we saw a synchronized slowdown across most economies across the world, 2021 is at least looking different. And even in sub-Saharan Africa, in key economies recently, growth has surprised positively. But there are still great issues stemming from the multi-speed nature of this recovery and the fact that we have seen this very uneven access to vaccines. A technical bounce back in growth in year-on-year terms after a very dramatic slowdown last year, the fact that countries are now growing, is a little bit less meaningful. What needs to happen is a much more comprehensive, sustained growth experience for African countries to really overcome the impact of the crisis. We know that the COVID crisis came at a real human cost. Unlike a lot of other more developed economies, there's very little fiscal room to introduce more stimulatory policies in Africa. For many sub-Saharan African countries especially, there just wouldn't have been the room for significant monetary easing, although central banks were able to add support where possible. The basic problem is this. It's going to take a while for economic momentum to be fully restored. Despite the good news of rising commodity prices, despite more positivity and optimism around prospects, we know that there is a meaningful difference stemming significantly from the uneven access to vaccines in terms of how quickly and how comfortably African economies will be able to put this economic crisis behind them. The good news is that new COVID containment measures are not necessarily associated with the same decline in economic activity that we saw for much of 2020. The bad news, though, is that the very uneven pace of the global economic recovery does raise risks for African economies. Even as we see investor sentiment improving, we see spread tightening in terms of Africa's external debt, suggesting that markets are now looking at a recovery scenario. We're not yet seeing significant new capital inflows into the region. And this is a big concern because as you might see other advanced economies recovering faster, having to change monetary policy settings even sooner, that could have a very detrimental impact on sub-Saharan Africa countries that have not seen the restoration of significant capital inflows yet. There has been a multilateral response, some of the debt service relief that was granted, extending the debt service standstill initiative. We know that for some countries, deeper debt treatment might be needed. Everyone is now looking to the support from an IMF SDR allocation, but we all know that even the multilateral response that we've seen so far isn't nearly sufficient to meet Africa's external financing requirements. Lastly, I would say that as we look to build back from the COVID crisis, we know that sub-Saharan African economies have a lot to offer. Given their demographics, faster growth in Africa could easily lift prospects in a much more meaningful way on a global level. But for an entire region of the world to be denied this contribution to global growth, partly because of the very inequitable access to vaccines, raises questions that do need to be addressed on a global level. The good news is the worst of the crisis, the economic crisis, seems to be behind us. The not so good news is that there are still significant challenges ahead.
Razia, thank you very much. We can move into questions now. And just a reminder that in addition to our panelists, we're joined by Dr. Richard Mahigo, Dr. Moeti's colleague, who'll also be available to take questions. First two questions are from Kenya. We have Maya Hayakawa from the BBC, and we have Berta Mensing from ZDF. Maya, could you go ahead with your question first, and then we'll hear from Berta.
All right, thank you very much. There's a lot of talk going on right now about the push to drop the patents for the manufacturing of vaccines. We know that even if that goes through, Africa doesn't quite have the capacity that it needs to manufacture locally. My question is whether the World Bank has any plans to finance the building of capacity of factories so that Africa can manufacture its own vaccines.
Thanks for that. And Berta, can you just give us your question, please?
Yes, thank you very much. Our question is if there's already any prognosis when the next batch of COVAX vaccines are expected, how much they would be, especially for countries like Kenya, where from next week the second doses are due and there's a prognosis for a fourth wave in June, July. Thank you.
Thanks for that. Dina, turning to you first, if we may, just with that question from Maya, on whether or not any of those funds that you were talking about are going to go into helping build manufacturing capacity across Africa.
Thanks so much, Maya, for the question. I think one of the things that the pandemic has shown is that it's a tragedy that there isn't ability to do manufacturing of vaccines in Africa. And I think as the World Bank, we see this as an area for support. But it's not something that happens overnight. Building manufacturing capacity for vaccines, and particularly some of the technology involved in COVID-19 vaccines, is a longer term endeavor. That said, we're in discussions as a World Bank group. We also have our IFC, the private sector wing, that actually previously, before the pandemic, had started talking to some countries in Africa and elsewhere about support for vaccine manufacturing. So over the medium term, we're exploring what options there are. We note that there are some places on the continent and in South Africa, in Senegal, where vaccines are produced currently, not for COVID, but for other things. So the question is, what will it take to support manufacturing capacity beyond what's happening now? And I think the last point is that this is something that is a longer term endeavor and will involve many partners, not only the World Bank. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Dina. And Dr. Moeti, can I turn to you on Berta's question on COVAX vaccines?
I'll start and then hand over to Richard to provide more detail. I mean, I think it is just true to say that there are significant challenges at the moment with the COVAX vaccine supplies, especially the AstraZeneca, which is produced, which is being manufactured by the Serum Institute of India, which has indicated it has real difficulties, which are understandable, I think, to provide the supplies as it sees this very difficult situation with a very severe wave of COVID-19. We are expecting this postponement to last certainly through the first part of the third quarter of the year, although there are discussions ongoing all the time to see if it's possible to get any supplies. The platform is looking at other vaccines as well, and I'll ask Richard to provide some details about when we are expecting what kind of volumes through COVAX. It is a big challenge at the moment.
Richard.
Yeah, thank you. Indeed, the supply crisis is something that is a very high concern for WHO, but for everybody now. We are definitely expecting these delays, which are going to affect several countries moving forward. In terms of the pipeline, there are promising deals that have been concluded by the COVAX, and notably with Moderna vaccine that is expecting to start being rolling out in the third quarter of this year. 500 million doses have been deal have been concluded with the delivery probably of the first delivery in 2021 of around 47 million doses. I think the same apply for the Novavax vaccine that also is expected to be delivered starting third quarter. But to go specifically to the issue of Kenya, I think which is not alone in that situation, we are also hoping that the current negotiation around donation by countries that have got excess number of doses. And we heard the good development in Dr. Moeti's introductory remarks with the U.S. We hope that this is going to get accelerated and as a short-term perspective of trying to fill the gap, particularly with the second dose that many countries are expecting to start delivering in the second part of June moving forward. So I will stop there.
Dr. Mahigo, thank you very much. We can go to Nigeria now and to Paul Adepoju from The Lancet. Paul, can we have your question? Just waiting for Paul to come online.
Thank you very much. My question, hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you, hello? Paul, go ahead.
Okay, my question is on the cost. The economic impact of vaccine expectancy in Africa. I don't know whether we can have specific figures that put this into perspective. Thank you.
Thanks for that. Perhaps we can turn to Razia on that. Paul's asking there about the economic impact of vaccine hesitancy. Are there any figures that give any indication on hesitancy? At the moment, obviously, it looks like the crisis that we're facing is one of distribution rather than people not coming forward and taking the vaccine.
Thank you, and that is exactly right. Very sadly, because of the very weak pace of vaccine administration that we've seen so far, we know that the bigger issue is just supply access to vaccines, supply of vaccines, access to it, and some of the logistical issues that had been outlined by Dr. Moeti. We don't yet have the luxury in any African country of trying to assess the impact of vaccine hesitancy simply because we're not there yet. We haven't even made a dent in terms of Africa's share of the global administration of vaccines. If we're looking at only 2% for the entire region, that does suggest that the issues are really much more around supply rather than vaccine hesitancy. So it would be very difficult to come up with any assessment of the economic cost of that vaccine hesitancy. What we do know, though, in terms of economic costs, is that There was a fiscal crisis almost across the region last year as domestic activity stalled, as commodity prices weakened. We did see government after government having to put in place plans to deal with the collapse of revenue. Now the good news is economic momentum is back. Commodity prices are starting to recover. This is helping revenue momentum to some extent, but there's a lot of lost ground to make up for. The real cost of this crisis is what is it going to take in terms of the funding to make up for some of those development losses, where the estimate is that perhaps as much as a decade of development gains may have been wiped out as a result of the COVID crisis. So not only is the starting point of African economies a lot weaker, with higher debt ratios, not because of the massive fiscal expansion, but because of the revenue deterioration, but there are also question marks still around where all the funding is going to come from.
Thanks for that, Razia. We're going to try and reach Donato Mancini from the Financial Times on the line. He's on audio connection. Donato, we got you?
Hi, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Thanks so much for taking my question. So, Donato Mancini from the FT. We reported last week that J&J was pressuring COVAX to accept shipments of its vaccine at fridge temperature, which would shorten their shelf life and increase the risk nations may not be able to fully use delivered vaccines before they expire. So is this something you have experienced with J&J and other drug makers? And my second question, which is related, is also about the shelf life. So does the shelf life pose an issue and a problem for the rollout of vaccines in the African continent, given there are structural issues, perhaps in the sort of last leg of delivery? And would you push for nations to ignore expiry dates in a bid to get more people immunized now that supply is so constrained? Thank you so much.
Thanks for that. Three questions there, all on the same theme. Perhaps Dr. Moeti, Dr. Mahiga, we can turn to you to address those.
Perhaps I'll start as well and then hand over to Richard. So starting with the second question, is the shelf life an issue? I guess when you say shelf life, you mean the expiry date in terms of efficacy of the vaccine. Is that an issue? First of all, these are new vaccines and there is data being collected all the time as the vaccines are being rolled out to find out for how long they keep their potency in terms of efficacy and reach the expiry date. So for example, with data that has been acquired recently from the UK, the Serum Institute of India is estimating now that the ideal time to have used the AstraZeneca vaccine is extended from about 12 weeks to 16 weeks. So I think what we can say is that this is something that is being consistently studied and looked at. And it is very encouraging, especially given the current situation with countries having given a first dose, that there's a possibility then of having an extended interval between the first and second doses when the vaccine's efficacy will not have been affected. So should these expiry dates be ignored, I think that it's important to be evidence-based in extending. So it's encouraging to know that this has happened, but I think we need to be wise and respect what is recommended as a duration of use of the vaccine based on the current knowledge in terms of the data, and then continue to learn as data is collected on the vaccine. So Richard, I'll turn to you to perhaps respond to the first question.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Moeti. For the J&J vaccine, we have not have a similar situation that what has been described. The J&J vaccine has so far only been implemented in South Africa, so there is no kind of large extension of this vaccination in the region. And we have to say that this vaccine normally is stored at the fridge temperature, so I think this should not be an issue with that. But maybe just to add a few things on what Dr. Moeti said on the shelf life, it poses an issue with delivery. Definitely yes, because countries are used to vaccines that have got a more longer expiry dates, several months to maybe 2 to 3 years. And this is the vaccines that are usually being delivered through the routine immunization. So indeed, when the vaccine comes with a very short shelf life, 3 months to 6 months, with all the delivery issues that we have seen, I think some doses are running the risk of being expiring before they get delivered. So I think the more we have a longer shelf life, I think the better to allow countries to plan appropriately and take time to deliver. And then finally, with the expiring date being ignored, I think 2 days ago, WHO APRO issued a very clear guidelines to countries to really follow the process in terms of the expiry date. We need here to mention that the expiry date is linked to the potency of the vaccine and the ability definitely to have a product that can work. So we cannot ignore that data. I think unless we have a clear stability information on the product for extending the shelf life of the vaccine, I think our recommendation has been to not use the vaccine beyond the current expiry date that has been provided by the manufacturer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mahigo. Questions now from South Africa and from Kenya. We have Hilary Joffe from the Sunday Times in South Africa and Mike Mwaniki from Health Business Magazine in Kenya. Hilary, can I just take your question first, please?
Thanks very much, Adrian, for taking my question, and good afternoon to the panel. You may know that in South Africa, the vaccine rollout, which has really just begun in earnest, is in part private sector funded. Through the mechanism of government requiring our medical schemes, that is our health insurers, to pay for their own members as a minimum benefit. And I wanted to ask the panel, firstly, is that private funding of a vaccination program, is that unique in the world or at least unusual in the world? And also from a policy perspective, what does the panel think of this approach to the financing of vaccination programs for COVID? What do you see as being the pros and indeed the cons? Thank you.
Thanks, Hilary. And Mike, can we have your question, please? Trying to get Mike Mwaniki from Health Business Magazine in Kenya.
Maybe. Good afternoon.
Hello, Mike. Your question.
Hello, how are you?
We're good.
Yes. Yes, my question goes to Dr. Mwaniki. How is WHO addressing the stoppage of export of the AstraZeneca vaccine to Kenya and other countries under the COVAX facility? And how will Kenya and other countries which have directly received the AstraZeneca vaccine doses for first round inoculation be able to undertake the second round? And what could be the consequences if they mixed instead give either Pfizer, J&J, or Moderna vaccine doses?
Mike, thank you for that. Perhaps first we can turn to Hilary's question, and it's not quite in the scope of our economists, but they're economists and they're ready to answer anything. So I'll put it to both of them. Razia and Dina, any observations on Hilary's remarks about how South Africa is funding its vaccine rollout?
Thank you very much, Hilary, for that question. So I think the key point is, would we have been seeing a much slower pace of vaccine rollout in the absence of what South Africa has done, where because there are medical aid schemes, because they do have significant membership, it's seen as a good solution, a reasonably good solution of helping the private sector to play a role in the rollout of vaccines. I'm not aware, and I will of course defer to Dina and Dr. Mwaniki on this, around similar schemes in other countries. There are vaccines that are privately available in other countries, and that does run the risk of bidding up the cost of these vaccines. But for South Africa, given the fiscal constraints that the country faces, given that it does have an established medical aid scheme system, where this is a neat enough financing solution, anything that accelerates the pace of vaccine rollout can only be seen as a positive in that respect.
Thanks, Razia. Dina, can I ask you for any observations you might have on Hillary's remarks?
Sure. I think the first point I would make is that vaccines are a classic public good, right? So that they don't just benefit the individual who gets the vaccine. They're important for communities, societies, and economies. So ensuring that they are adequately financed regardless of source is critical. I can't comment on the specific South Africa case, but I can say that across the continent, health systems are not well funded, right? So health spending, we estimate, at least in the countries that I cover in West and Central Africa, it hovers around 1% of GDP, which is tiny given the needs that we see in health, and about less than 6% of government budgets. So I think we need public funding, and private funding can complement, but I don't think it's a substitute, particularly in Africa. Thank you.
Thanks, Dina. Turning now to Dr. Moeti for any observations on that question, but also on this issue of the AstraZeneca stoppage and how WHO is addressing that issue.
Yes, I think I agree with both Dina and Razia's observations that you know, with the limitation of financing for health in Africa, there have been attempts to engage the private sector and get them to contribute. Of course, it's very important, as Razia said, that that's done in a way that doesn't produce distortions in terms of equity then of whatever commodity or service. So I think with an established private financing system, as happens in South Africa, and the challenges at the moment, I think it can only be a good thing. It just needs to be carefully managed so that you don't get then distortions and inequities being exacerbated by this. But it's a good move. I've heard of other countries as well where there are public vaccination sites, but there's the opportunity for people who have the funding to be vaccinated privately, and hopefully that's also not done in ways that would distort the pricing. So generally, we in our work are encouraging governments to engage the private sector in financing for health more broadly. And I know that the African health private sector has been very much involved in the response to the pandemic, even going beyond this vaccine issue. Yeah. As far as what WHO has been doing to address the vaccine shortages, of course, we work very much as an active partner in the COVAX platform. I mean, starting just with the main supplier for the moment of COVAX, our Director General and the team working closely with him have been very much engaged in advocacy negotiation with the Indian government, with the Serum Institute of India about delivering supplies, while recognizing very well that India is a country with a huge population facing at the moment a very difficult situation. WHO has also been advocating with other countries that have the kind of supplies in reserve of vaccine to carry out dose sharing and to do so in significant and meaningful quantities as soon as possible. That's why we're so encouraged by the announcement made by the United States government that it's going to do that with 80 million doses and do so partly or mainly through the COVAX. And then the platform has been looking to diversify the vaccines that it is going to procure. It's also talking, I believe, to J&J and to Moderna. Perhaps Richard can give details on that. So it's a matter of trying to continue with the partners already in hand, expanding those vaccines that the COVAX mechanism is looking at, and then also providing advice on countries on how to our countries on how to optimize the impact of the doses that they've got, because we understood that some countries, when they became concerned about these looming shortages, then started slowing down their campaigns in order to keep doses to deliver a second dose. Whereas we are recommending that it's important to vaccinate with the first dose as many people as possible, because then that helps to prevent severe disease and minimize the severe impact on the health system. So Richard, maybe you can provide a bit more detail about which other vaccines the COVAX platform is looking at.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Moeti. Since the beginning, I think approach that the COVAX facility took was really to have a much wider portfolio of candidate vaccines that are going to be considered. And that was exactly a plan to avoid the situation in which we are in currently, to be too dependent or reliant on one supplier only. So I saw one question saying, is COVAX too relying on one supplier? I think that was an issue that definitely one would avoid. But the pipeline is quite very promising. As I said, there are now several deals that are currently have been concluded. We are probably going to see the supply situation improving in the third to fourth quarter of the year, and potentially ramping up considerably early next year. One other option, and I saw some of the question in line with that, and to respond to the issue raised by Mike from Kenya, the provision of a second dose with a different vaccine. We've heard that dose suggestion, either providing a J&J vaccine as a second dose when someone has received AstraZeneca's first dose, or alternative other products. The WHO position so far has been that we need data, we need some evidence to make any recommendation in that regard. There is, of course, a very promising area of research in this area, particularly for the vaccines that are using the same platform, like the AstraZeneca vaccine, the J&J vaccine, the Sputnik V vaccine, are all what we call viral vector vaccines. They're using literally the same platform. So in theory, it could be easier for such a vaccine to be provided as a second dose. But again, we need absolutely to get critical data to move towards such a recommendation. And there are many studies that are currently done. And we hope to have enough information on that so that this question that is coming often can be responded with clear evidence and data.
Thanks, Dr. Mahigo. Questions now from Botswana. We have Motshidizi Ramashebe from Botswana Television, and we have Stacey Najjar from Vice News. Motshidizi, could we get your question first, please?
All right. Hello. I really wanted to know how far we are in producing our own African vaccine, or if there are any conversations on that, and if there are conversations on that, how are they going? And will the WHO assist us to give us resources to make our own? Thank you.
Thanks for that. And Stacey Najjar.
Sure, thanks for taking my question. When you consider the pace of the vaccine rollout, at this point, how are you advising countries to protect their populations in order to prevent a situation like we're witnessing unfold in India, especially when you consider the economic challenges that were described at the beginning of the call?
Thanks for that, Stacey. Starting perhaps, Dr. Mehti, with Motshidizi's question, and it's already been detailed earlier in the call that there are vaccine production facilities in both South Africa and Senegal, although not for COVID. How far away are we from seeing African manufacturing for a COVID vaccine?
Okay. Yes, there are active discussions going on, for example, for potential local production in South Africa with Aspen. And, you know, we have, as I said, vaccine-producing facilities in Senegal and also in some of the North African countries that have been producing vaccine. I think it's not something that's going to happen very quickly, and certainly it's not going to happen quickly enough to have an impact on the current situation, on the current very critical situation. There's a great deal of interest by some of the high-income countries to start discussions with some African countries, and that's actually starting to happen from some members of the European Union with some African countries to start talking about providing support, providing financing, getting into partnerships on local production of vaccines. But in my view, as I said in my statement, these are medium to long-term matters, because I think if you know, it's one thing to produce vaccines in this emergency mode and establish the infrastructure to do that. I think it'll need not only an injection of cash from another country, you probably will need to find investors in the process. I believe it's something that needs to be looked at more broadly and going beyond manufacturing these vaccines in order for it to be a viable venture. We've had in the past local production.
Could I just interrupt briefly, just for people on the call who are not as familiar as obviously you and your colleagues are with the kind of time frames we're talking about? You've been very clear that you don't think vaccine manufacturing will be something that we can bring in to the current crisis. But when you're talking about the time frame, are we talking 3 to 5 years perhaps, or 5 to 10 years in terms of actually setting up these facilities?
It's very difficult for me to tell. I would think at least 3 years to get to the agreements and also to look at all the other elements that are needed to start local production of vaccines, because it's not only a matter of making the facility, building the infrastructure, but it's also other agreements with those who hold, as was mentioned by somebody, the intellectual property, the technology transfer, the training of the people who are going to do the production. So I think it's something that will take a few years at the very least, so perhaps 3 years minimum, I would say possibly even more. But there's a great push and a great deal of interest both from high-income countries and also from African political leaders and those pharmaceutical companies that already have a base in Africa. They're also interested in working on this effort together, is what I would say.
And perhaps you can just bring Dina in on this. Dina, the World Bank obviously funds very long-term as well as emergency projects. What kind of time frame might it be before, to Mochadizi's question, we can see African facilities manufacturing African vaccines for something like COVID?
Yeah, I mean, like Dr. Moeti, I think it's difficult to say an exact time frame, but I think, there was some discussion in Senegal, for example, could they do some of the finish and fill, so not producing their own, but sort of taking raw ingredients, and that could happen perhaps in 2022. So, and then more domestic manufacturing a year after that, but that's really a tentative estimate. Adrian, if I may, can I tackle Stacey's an attempt at Stacey's question? Sure, because I think it's an excellent one, and I think, you know, as you say, the small share of the population that's been vaccinated really underscores the need for ongoing support to the response to the pandemic, including testing, surveillance, making sure that labs have the capacity to track variants, therapeutics. The India circumstances really underscore the need for oxygen, and very few countries have the capacity to have oxygen concentrators. So from the perspective of the World Bank, we're continuing to support countries in this way, and also through our ongoing work on health system strengthening and building capacity at the primary care level so that, that countries can continue to respond to this this pandemic and the virus.
Thanks for that. Come to Reza perhaps in a minute, but Dr. Mehty, just to go back to you on the measures addressing Stacey's question about what can be done to prevent or perhaps put off the experience that India has had. And you mentioned right at the very outbreak of the pandemic, the experience that African health systems have with dealing with infectious disease. Is that something that will serve Africa in the coming months?
Yes, I think it's something that will continue to serve Africa in the coming period, especially now with the vaccine-related difficulties. And just to supplement what Dina started to say, you know, it's important to particularly help the population to play their part in all of this. You know, the continuous wearing of masks, the keeping of distances and the hygiene measures, washing of hands, making sure that what you do doesn't help to transmit the vaccine. I think we've gained a lot of experience now in living with some of these, what we consider abnormal practices. So I think I'm sure people can see the degree to which you need to be using your sanitizer in terms of what you've been doing in the last year and have not been infected. I've seen, and we have seen a huge dropping off of these measures at the individual and community level. And I believe this needs a lot of reinforcing. We've learned now what works, and we know that in some countries, people at the low income level actually can't afford to buy a mask. I think that governments need to learn from this experience and take on some of these measures in order to prevent having to resort to lockdowns. We've learned as well about how to carry out these measures in ways that are not comprehensive lockdowns that totally paralyze movement in a country, but to use data and apply some of these measures more locally. So I think we need to use the learning from the last year to sustain public health measures, to sustain personal prevention measures, and also to target more accurately the more severe measures that then cause difficulties with people's incomes. And most importantly, we need to continue to communicate with people to encourage resumption, I think, now of some of the measures. When I go to the city in the town that I live in Brazzaville, many people are no longer wearing masks. People are walking around in public as if the vaccine is, the virus is no longer circulating. This needs a lot of effort, in my view.
Thanks for that. Reza, just to draw you in on this, to the question about vaccine production in Africa, is this something the private sector would or could play a role in addressing?
Thank you, Adrian. So I think the point that had been made earlier by Dr. Moeti around the intellectual property discussions that are taking place, whatever needs to be in place for this to be a reality, the sad part of this is going to be time consuming, and even with the best will in the world and the efforts of many, including the WTO, the perhaps most ambitious timetable is that we would be looking at something by the end of the year before there's further clarity on this. Now, having that certainty is a very important part of being able to attract the financing. This is seen as much more of a medium-term solution. I think there's widespread recognition, as was stated by the speakers here, that this isn't something that can necessarily be turned on. It's not like you can turn the switch on and suddenly there's that much more production capacity. But certainly in terms of thinking of the pandemic preparedness in the future, in terms of thinking what needs to be done to boost the provision of healthcare services more generally, what needs to be done to encourage that manufacturing in a greater number of localities, these are all important issues that do need policy solutions to be formulated now.
Thanks, Rosia. I think we've got time for one last question. We can go to Kenya and to Reuters and Omar Mohammed. Omar, your question, please.
Hi, thank you for taking the time. I have a couple of very quick questions. One is, what's more urgent right now? Is access more urgent than financing? And two, I had a question, clarification on something that Dr. Ngeka Song said earlier in his briefing, that if there's no access to AstraZeneca, maybe countries should think about supplementing their first dose with the J&J dose. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Omar. I know we addressed the issue of mixing some of those platform doses just earlier with Dr. Mahigo. Can I turn to each of our panelists for their sort of closing thoughts? And I think your question really comes to the heart of it, Omar, which is what is most urgent right now? Is it access to vaccine or is it financing? Dr. Moeti.
Yes, I actually do think right now it's access to vaccines. It's access to surplus doses of vaccines because there have been offers of additional finance for the COVAX facility. But I think and there have been huge attempts in the work that the African Union has been doing with the Afrexim Bank to access vaccines. I think the issue is access to vaccine supplies. Of course, finance is very important. Then for, as we were saying with Dana, not only for the procurement of the vaccines, but also for the delivery operations of these vaccines. So, but I think right now it's really access to the vaccines and the ability to buy the vaccines, even with some of the resources that already exist.
Thanks for that. And turning to our two economists, obviously access, Dr. Moeti saying there, is the most vital aspect of the current issue, the current problem. But how much is financing going to carry on being important throughout this crisis, and how is that going to be addressed by both public and private?
We know that financing is needed for a variety of different things. I absolutely agree with Dr. Moeti that when it comes to the vaccines, access is the priority right now. Financing, there are a multitude of solutions. There's much more time to think of what needs to be in place. And it isn't just financing for the vaccines. Let's not forget that what we're up against is an effort to try to reverse this loss of development gains that the region has seen in the recent past. There are many more conversations to be had on financing, but we also need to recognize that there are many more innovative solutions that can be applied. The immediate priority, the urgency, is around access.
Dina.
I fully agree with my fellow panelists. I think ensuring that Africa has access to a supply of safe and effective vaccines is the critical priority. That said, I think the work that countries have done to prepare for the vaccine needs to continue, and there are investments that we know need to be made now and can be made now to get ready, including in the cold chain, including in training of vaccinators, including in public engagement. And I agree with the conversation earlier on hesitancy that in a way we don't have the luxury because of the supply, but I think we need to get ahead of that. And I think we have seen in a number of countries that misinformation has slowed even the initial rollout. And I just want to mention a striking example from Cote d'Ivoire that I heard about this week, where when they started their rollout in March with the COVAX vaccines, they were reaching only 2,000 doses a day, deploying 2,000 doses a day, largely because of hesitancy. And now they're up to 20,000 a day because of public engagement, because of different approaches to the rollout. So I think there's a lot that countries can do so that they can hit the ground running when the vaccines arrive. And at the World Bank, we look forward to continuing to work with countries and our partners on this endeavor. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dina. And a big thank you to all our panelists, especially Drs. Moeti and Mahigo, but also to Dana Ringold and to Razia Khan for joining us. Thanks for all of your questions. Sorry we haven't been able to get to everyone's in the time available. But from here in Geneva to all of you, wherever you are, have a good rest of your day and thank you for joining us.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, May 22nd, 2021. That was a World Health Organization briefing focusing on the access of various COVID-19 vaccines on the African continent. And the meeting was addressed by the Africa Regional Director for the World Health Organization, Dr. Masadiso Mwete, as well as other figures from various institutions internationally. Right now, we want to take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment here at the Pan-African Journal. Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast for Saturday, May 22nd, 2021. That was the voice of Candy Staten. And right now we want to go into our final segment. We have excerpts from various developments on the African continent and internationally. Let's listen in from CGTN.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
Nigerian Chief of Army Staff dies in Air Force plane crash. China's President Xi Jinping calls for solidarity in face of the pandemic at a G20 virtual health summit. And on World Biodiversity Day, we look at efforts by Africa to preserve its biodiversity. Hello, welcome to Africa Live. As always, great to have you with us. I'm Richard Ntah, live in Nairobi. And for those of you joining us from across the continent and around the globe, we thank you for joining us. Let's take a look at other stories making headlines this hour. Ethiopia's commodity exchange is set to introduce new products to its platform. And Football League resumes in Zimbabwe after an 18-month break. Once again, welcome to Africa Live. So good to have you with us. Let's begin in Nigeria, where the president, Muhammadu Buhari, has expressed shock at the death of his chief of army staff, Ibrahim Atahiru. Buhari had appointed Atahiru in January this year. An army spokesperson said Atahiru was among 11 military officers who died in an Air Force plane crash in Kaduna State on Friday. Military sources say the officers were on an official trip to Kaduna when the incident occurred. The immediate cause of the plane crash is yet to be ascertained. The identities of the other military officers aboard the ill-fated aircraft are also yet to be revealed. President Buhari described them as, quote, heroes who paid the ultimate price for peace and security in the land, close quote. All right, let's get you more on this. We are joined by Tessem Akende in Jos. Tessem, welcome to the program. Welcome to Africa Live. Can you give us an update on this particular incident?
Well, the update at the moment is that the Chief of Army Staff is scheduled for burial by 1 p.m. Nigerian time today and six other military personnel who were on that crash. The other update is the fact that the Chief of Defense Staff has ordered a military investigation board to be put together to investigate the causes to what actually happened, that led to the death of the Chief of Army Staff. Sequel to that, the Air Force, which one of its fleets was being used yesterday, has also, ordered investigation into what actually made the aircraft for the mishap to happen. So these are the recent updates.
All right, Tessem, I guess you basically answered my next question. So is it safe to say we do not actually know the cause of the crash, Tessem?
Yes, like I said, an investigation has begun in the whole issue. The Chief of Defense Staff, like I said, has ordered for an accident investigation board to be put together. But the Defense Headquarters yesterday attributed the cause of the crash to bad weather. We don't know whether this will change as the findings continue. But that's about what we can hold on to now as regards the cause of what happened, quoting military sources.
All right. Tessem, how is the death of the Nigerian military chief of staff likely to affect efforts by government to secure the country?
Well, I'm not sure I heard you clearly, but if you are actually asking about his commitment to the security issue, if that is what you're actually asking, he was appointed the Chief of Army Staff in January this year, and he has been, going round military formations, charging them up and, giving them the assurance of the fact that as leader of the army in this country, he will lead them aright, and he will, in the face of security challenges before Nigeria. Nigeria has, been battling security challenges, insurgency, for over a decade now. And his appointment came as a morale booster, having new oxygen into the fight. And many actually see him as that game changer in the fight. So the entire military architecture is really, the morale is down now, but this has happened, and we look forward to the findings that will come out of, from the accident investigation board that is being put together.
Tessa McKende, thank you for that update and report. We appreciate your insights. Thank you very much. Moving on, Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau is proclaimed dead. The Wall Street Journal, citing Nigerian intelligence on Friday, reported that Shekau died after he detonated a suicide vest during an ambush by his rival Islamic State terror group. According to the report, hundreds of Islamic State fighters attacked Shekau's base in Timbuktu Triangle region of Nigeria's Sambisa Forest on Wednesday. In 2015, Shekau pledged allegiance to Islamic State. Boko Haram then rebranded itself as Islamic State West Africa Province, or ISWAP. But internal disputes involving Islamic State naming another leader to lead ISWAP pushed Shekau to reassume leadership of Boko Haram. The militant group has conducted numerous deadly attacks and abductions in Nigeria's northwest since it initiated an Islamic insurgency in 2009. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for more contributions by the group of 20 countries in the global fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. He was speaking at the Global Health Summit, a virtual conference aimed at coordinating worldwide efforts against the pandemic.
I urge G20 countries in collaboration with the United Nations to assume a strong leadership role in ending this devastating global pandemic. Together, we can and we must build a healthier, safer, fairer, and more sustainable world.
Well, at the end of the event, G20 leaders issued a joint declaration to promote sustained financing cooperation for global health. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen described the statement as, quote, groundbreaking and historical, close quote. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus also took part in the summit. He called on G20 members to share more vaccine doses and boost vaccine production. Leaders of the world's largest economies have gathered virtually to discuss cooperation against the COVID-19 pandemic. Aid pledges have been made for vaccine development, production, and global economic recovery. China made bold new commitments at the summit, with President Xi Jinping calling for solidarity in the fight against the pandemic. CGTN Sun Ye has more on his report, his remarks.
China will provide an additional $3 billion in international aid over the next 3 years to support COVID-19 response and economic and social recovery in other developing countries. We have already supplied 300 million doses of vaccines to the world, and we will do our utmost to provide even more vaccines.
To offer as many vaccines to the international community to the best of China's capability. This was one of the pledges delivered by Chinese President Xi Jinping to the G20 Global Health Summit. He also announced China's decision to waive intellectual property rights on COVID-19 vaccines and share know-how with developing countries. He says this are what responsible countries must do at critical times like this, in line with building what China calls a community of health. Last May, President Xi Jinping said that China's vaccines would be made a global public good. It was among the first countries to make such an announcement.
It's been more than a year since COVID-19 struck, but we're still facing so much uncertainty that has come with the pandemic. The world needs confidence, hope, and cooperation. So at this critical moment, President Xi Jinping's speech is particularly meaningful for the global fight against COVID-19, for trust in multilateralism, and for the improvement of global health governance.
China has provided vaccine assistance to over 80 countries and offered vaccines to the UN peacekeeping operations and the International Olympic Committee. Chinese President Xi Jinping said at the Global Health Summit that China will continue to make efforts to close the divide in vaccine. Sun Ye, CGTN, Beijing.
Waiving intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines will not be enough
to narrow the huge vaccine supply gap between rich and poor countries. And this is according to the World Trade Organization Director General Nkosi Okonjo-Iweala. Speaking to the European Parliament, the WTO chief said it was clear that an IP waiver alone would not be enough without transfer of technology and know-how. It came as the EU said it would invest in manufacturing hubs rather than a waiver.
If you get IP without transfer of technology and know-how, you also cannot, if you don't have that, vaccines are quite complicated and difficult. So you also need to be able to do that. Now, let me end that whole section by saying that I'm very convinced, and I think that what the Parliament could help with is, again, with getting our members to sit down at the table to actually negotiate a text, to have solved the problem, the unacceptable problem of inequity in access to vaccines. We have to be holistic. It's not one or the other. If we don't pursue a comprehensive strategy that I outlined before, I do not believe that we will increase the volume of vaccines.
Last year, South Africa and India called for the suspension for a limited time to intellectual property protection for patents related to the treatment of COVID-19. The move has been widely supported by developing countries that fear they will bear the brunt of the pandemic. Well, earlier we spoke to Dr. Ngoy Nsenga, the COVID-19 incident manager for the WHO Regional Office for Africa, on the implications of the decision for the continent.
We have to recognize that Africa has done tremendous progress in terms of fighting outbreak. You might recall that some years back, I mean, the most memorable example is the Ebola in West Africa, how we struggled, the outbreak went for years, actually. But lately, you could have noticed that the Ebola outbreak that we have had in our region, even though they are still in terms of magnitude big outbreak, but at least Africa or African countries managed to contain those outbreaks relatively short time. You have noticed as well that one of the challenges that Africa has had during COVID is this overly dependence from outside in importing most of the supplies, especially at the beginning. At least now some of the some African countries again made some progress, but still Africa is still overly dependent from outside. And more so for specialized supply, including vaccine and medicine. So there is no other way. That's why I will keep saying this, and that when in all discussions with your colleagues, there is no other way than Africa to become resilient. I mean, for Africa to build health resilient health system, we need to build our own manufacturing capacity, including not only in terms of medicine and vaccine, but also including in terms of the diagnosis. We need to manufacture our own tests so that we can expand the testing capacity to detect as soon as possible the cases and manage those cases in timely manner.
The news continues on Africa Live. More news after the break. Here's what's ahead. China's father of hybrid rice dies, age 91. We look at his contribution to food security in Africa.
Africa is a continent of diversity, with varied climates and enchanting geography, and a people so distinct, but with a shared enduring spirit. We are at the heart of the continent to bring you the untold stories.
Let's have a look.
We celebrate Africa as it shapes its own destiny.
I've been sure she's tuned in. Cairo.
Syria.
Juba.
Johannesburg.
Ethiopia.
Tanzania.
Africa Live. Find your voice.
Welcome back. And you were listening to Africa Live from CGTN. And we're going to be ending out our program for today, Saturday, May 22nd, 2021. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program, all you have to do is go to our website at the radio network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you want to read the Pan-African Newswire, you can go to panafricannews.blogspot.com. We're going to be closing our program out with the legendary Wes Montgomery along with the Wynton Kelly Trio at the Half Note from 1965. This is Abayomi Azikiwe. Have a beautiful week. Thank you.